This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for August 4th, 2020. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels, and I am very glad you're here to hear my conversation with Alon Ashkari. You've heard Alon's work if you have seen Layer Cake, 47 Ronin, Ninja Assassin, or for that matter, Austinland, the Shaun the Sheep movie, arthouse fare like Black Sea, Still Alice, or the Ralph Fiennes version of Coriolanus, or if you've played The Sims 4. If you've seen Hannibal Rising, you have actually heard Alon collaborate with Shigeru Umebayashi, with whom he has now collaborated again on the score to Ghost of Tsushima, Sucker Punch and Sony's sprawling samurai open world thing. What exactly is Ghost of Tsushima? What is the emotional core of it? What is the player doing moment to moment? How should that be reflected in the music? We talk a fair bit about that and how Alon thinks of it, which I think is a bit different than how, you know, designers or visual artists might think of it. We talk a fair bit about how much a composer should think about cultural context and historical accuracy, how much a composer should think about a figure like the samurai that has become a political hot potato. If the game is not about those associations, to what degree should or shouldn't they be on your mind? It's a pretty good talk. Alon also just shares some great stories about projects he's worked on and folks he's worked with. In fact, we were just sort of talking about Chicago before I turned the mics on, and he launched into a story about working with the Wachowskis on Ninja Assassin. So that's when I insisted we turned the mics on, and that is where you will join us. Enjoy. Now we're all in the clear. So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, not at all. Yeah, so when I met James McTeague, he suggested that I came out and worked at the Wachowski studio there where they were making the film, because the Wachowski siblings were producing the film, involved in producing it. So I went and spent a few months out there. They were incredibly hospitable, and it was amazing walking around their studio, because sort of in the unused back rooms were all the sort of bits and pieces and models from the Matrix. So it was really, really amazing. But they're very, very kind and generous people to work with. They'd get us a weekly massage, and there was always lots of lovely food. And anyway, and I hung out in Chicago for quite a while, and I loved it. I loved being there. It was a great time. And it was towards the end of the summer, I drove out to some of the lakes with my girlfriend at the time. And yeah, we just had a fantastic time. I have very fond memories of Chicago.
It's a beautiful place. And it honestly has an incredible food and music culture, just culture in general, in a way that only places with really bad weather tend to. I think like we were talking a bit before the mics turned on about Montreal. It's very similar, right? Like there's this incredible food culture and this incredible, you know, history to it, specifically because you have to hunker down for some rather unpleasant weather.
Yeah.
So we dove right into Ninja Assassin. We're here to talk about something more to do with samurai than shinobi, although the line gets blurry. Let's start somewhere simple, and then we'll sort of branch out from there, if you wouldn't mind. We're mostly here to talk about your work on Ghost of Tsushima. So I'm not sure I've actually just heard you describe the game. How would you describe the project? What is Ghost of Tsushima?
For me, it's a timeless story, because It's about the battle of youth and discovery of the new against the importance of upholding upholding tradition, and every generation has its own battle with this. You know, the older generation trying to hold on to what was made, and the younger generation trying to forge ahead with something new, and it's part of the struggle of being a human being, and that is captured completely in Jin, the main character, because this is really what drew me to the project, is that he is an emotional crisis the whole way through, and because he has been trained in a certain way, and to believe and respect certain ways of doing things. And it's his entire belief system, his entire moral structure. But in order to save the people that he loves and the home that he loves, he has to break with all of that and do something different. And so he's in having an emotional struggle, he's in constant emotional turmoil. And that's a very rich place from which to experience all emotions and from which to write music.
Certainly, yeah. I think you said elsewhere that you're not especially interested in doing action at this moment, because what you've sort of settled on as your driving ethos is expressing emotion, like specific, rich, complicated emotions through your music, which I think you do quite well in everything you work on. And so the idea of just doing a straight action piece with a bunch of fight music wasn't especially interesting to you, but this idea of internal conflict and the idea of what's going on inside Jin's head, that was something you felt like you could sink your teeth into, and that's when you decided you wanted to be involved in the project.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, there's only so many car chases or that you can do in your career before you're like, you know, how many different approaches are there to that, right? Sure. And so at the beginning, it's really exciting to have your opportunity to get to do something like that. But by the time you've done a few, and I have, it stops being creatively inspiring, at least for me. And you start, you know, I can't think of an exact project, but I can think of times where I've got to the action sequence and I've been like, oh God, how am I gonna get through all of this? And where I just wanted to write the other bits, you know? And I can also remember earlier on in my career being really excited about doing action and wanting to, you know, so anyway, but yeah, as my work has developed, what I've become interested in is emotional narrative. And of course there's, you know, there'll always be bits of action and things to do that, you know, that comes with the job, but there needs to be something else for me to sink my teeth into.
Right. Well, this is definitely a project where the action, you know, itself inherently has those extra layers to it. I mean, because your samurai stories, and maybe even more specifically samurai cinema, which the game draws from quite a bit, you know, the action sequences are not necessarily, you know, one person against the world. It's just as often duels, it's showdowns, it's moments of action that are very much rooted in character and plot and theme. And I think that comes through beautifully in your score.
Well, thank you. And I think also what's important is that it's not action and fighting and violence for the sake of action and fighting and violence. There has to be a reason for it in the plot, and an emotional driving force behind it. And Ghost is full of that. I mean, to the point at which, you know, and I'd be very careful not to give any spoilers here, but there's one particular fight in this game where I thought, and I said to Sucker Punch, to PlayStation, I said, you know, when the player is having this fight, needs to have all the power of a fight, but they need to have tears in their eyes. I want them to like be struggling to see the screen because their eyes are full of tears. And those were the kinds of challenges I was setting myself within the context of fight music.
Yeah. Is the fight, no spoilers, but is the fight you're speaking of the last one in the main plot?
Yeah, yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely an intense moment. I actually finished the main game last night.
Were there tears in your eyes?
Oh, I don't cry easily with media, so it was like, it was that thing where I was not quite crying, but I actually had to get up and walk away because, I mean, again, this is not a spoiler, but you, there is a choice to be made toward, you know, at the end of the game, and I did the fight, realized what was happening, and just sort of got up and like went to the other room and talked to my wife and said, I'm not sure what I'm going to do about this. So you sent me into emotional turmoil, and I do think, you know, the entire game is lavishly designed. The environmental art in particular is gorgeous, but the score is a huge part of that. These especially the bespoke moments of showdown and duel and as you say, internal conflict, that really makes it.
Yeah, great, good.
Yeah, working as intended, I would say. So this is a collaborative score, as a lot of your scores are, it should be said. Lair Cake, from Lair Cake to Shaun the Sheep, right? You work with other songwriters, composers, et cetera, a lot. In the case of this one, you sort of, you know, rekindled a collaboration from the days of Hannibal Rising, if I'm not mistaken.
It was actually a complete coincidence. And you're right. I first collaborated with Shigeru Umebayashi. We call him Ume. I first collaborated with him many, many years ago on Hannibal Rising. And that was perhaps more for traditional collaboration where we exchanged ideas and things. But on this game, the Sucker Punch and PlayStation had very clear ideas about what they wanted Ume to, what areas they wanted Ume to work on, what areas they wanted me to work on. And so there was actually no crossover at all. We worked in the same studios and with some of the same musicians. We had a fabulous dinner together in Tokyo. and it was lovely to see him again. But all in all, I'm really proud to be able to share credit with such a great master as Ume. And, you know, I wouldn't get myself involved in a collaboration that I wasn't comfortable with or that I didn't, but where I didn't really respect or admire the other person. So even though we focused on different things, I'm still, and I didn't know it was going to be that way at the start. But I was up for it, for any kind of collaboration with Ume because he is who he is.
So for Hannibal Rising, it was, when you say it was a more traditional collaboration, you worked together and sort of were co-authors of the whole score, co-composers, however you want to put it.
No, again, we did focus on different areas, but there was a little bit more cross-fertilization. We spent quite a lot of time in Abbey Road recording together. Hmm. So it was more collaborative. But it wasn't a co-write in the way, you know, you mentioned Shaun the Sheep. On Shaun the Sheep, I just sat down, you know, with some rock and roll friends of mine and we wrote a song together from start to finish. And so it wasn't a collaboration in that sense.
Sure. Or I think maybe of Austin Land. Am I remembering the name of the film? Yeah. So there, you know, the songs in it and your score have overlap of melody, right? Like that's, there's a
absolutely. And again, that was a project that I was desperate to work with Jerusha and Jared. Jerusha was directing this one because I was such a fan of Napoleon Dynamite. And in fact, we met on set and Jerusha met me and I was the first composer she met. We got on so well, she canceled all the other meetings. She was like, I'll work with you, it's great. And then when I saw the film, I just immediately knew that my friend Emmy the Great was the right artist for the film. So I introduced her to Jerusha and they got on like a house on fire too. And yeah, and so we, you know, I wrote the score, but me and Emma wrote the songs. You know, probably more Emma than me, but you know, we wrote them together.
Sure. So in the case of you, and I don't feel comfortable calling him Ume, but you did it, so I'll do it just as by way of reference, because I don't know the gentleman. I'm a big fan of his work though. You two didn't do that, basically. You didn't,
no,
like,
we
there
didn't,
was less of being in the same room.
We didn't come in a room together and come up with a team, so it wasn't a collaboration.
Exactly. And from what I, when you say you divvied things up, my understanding, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that he did more of the sort of open world bits and you did more of sort of the character and plot beat bits.
Well, yeah. Well, apart from that, I did all the action, all the fighting, and all the open world bits.
Oh, I see. So the exploration music is more him, and the fighting music is more you. Even if both are sort of pretty seamless when you're playing.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Interesting. So you said it was the studio that wanted that. They sort of had in their head the two sounds that I know when they did a temp score, they actually were using some of his music and some of your music when they were like demoing the game early. So did they, you know, the idea came from them that this was how the work ought to be sort of divvied up?
Absolutely. They completely drove that. They were like, you do this and you, yeah, he'll do that. And, you know, it didn't really, I wasn't, it didn't affect my process at all. And also, you know, the PlayStation guys are just, they're so experienced, the music department, and they're so brilliant and kind and considerate and respectful of their artists that I had complete confidence in the choices that they were making.
That's, yeah, and they specifically have quite a bit of experience as an outsider, it seems to me, with having projects with multiple composers be cohesive and coherent. I think of Bloodborne as a really good example. There's actually a great game developers conference talk where some of the composers and the producer of that game talked about how, I believe there are three or four composers on Bloodborne, and they all picked a set of instrumentation and you know, sort of some rules, but then they all worked independently. And you wouldn't necessarily know it when you're playing the game, because it does sort of sound of a piece. And I feel like Ghost of Tsushima, like if I didn't know going in that Ghost of Tsushima wasn't all sort of written by one person, I'm not sure I'd have had any idea.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear. Good to hear.
No, I mean it. I'm not blowing smoke. And I suppose the other thing is just keeping the Bloodborne comparison in mind, they spoke a bit about how they thought a bit about how, you know, it's sort of a Victorian horror thing. And they spoke a bit about how it should sound a bit like the Victorian era, but more than that, it should sound like the way we culturally think about the Victorian era. You know, instruments that were not necessarily in place at the time, but that we associate with Bram Stoker or whatever. This seems a bit different than that. It seems to me that you really, I mean, like besides collaboration, which I want to talk about a bit more, the other thing that sort of defines your work to me is research. You seem like you're a consummate researcher of different musical styles and instruments and things like that. And, you know, the impression I got was that you really were thinking about music from the period more than, you know, samurai cinema, more than, you know, Fumio Hayasaka or composers who worked with Akira Kurosawa. You were more thinking about what did Japan in the 13th century sound like? Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, this again came from Sucker Punch. They had a desire to have great authenticity in their approach to the game, to the point at which they got leaves from the island of Tsushima so that they could make their game look more like the island. The leaves in the game look more realistic. So I was really inspired by this search for authenticity, and I started doing my own research, finding out what folk music was around then, what religious music was around then, what instruments they played, and I met this incredible professor, Professor David Hughes, who's one of the great masters in the world of Japanese music. And he teaches in London, luckily for me. And I started learning to understand Japanese harmony, Japanese scales, Japanese melody, how these things are constructed. And having that information allowed me to be able to write for the instruments and learn how the instruments worked. And then I worked a lot with the players and learned from the players how to write in a traditional or at least in a way that was very natural for the instruments. I was inspired by folk song melody, by Shomyo monk singing and chants, and also researching instruments. And then I found, for me, one of the most exciting discoveries was this instrument called the biwa, actually the Satsuma biwa. And the biwa is in many ways the most warlike of instruments, because it's the instrument that the samurai learned to play. Mm-hmm. And it was part of their training. Slightly anachronistic, they probably would have started to have learned to play it a little bit after this period, like 100 years later, but it's not entirely clear. They may have played it at this time too, but they learned to play it as part of their training, and they could sing their exploits on this instrument. And what was really amazing, and I may be slightly romanticizing this, but I don't think I am, is that in the middle of the last century, or towards the end of the last century, that the tradition of playing the biwa was virtually lost, and there was only one great master of the instrument left. And that master taught a handful of people who are still around today. And one of those people is Junko Ueda. And she is a very spiritual performer. She sings shomyo, monk chants, as well as playing the biwa. And she's a consummate musician. And again, luckily for me, she lives in Spain. And so it was easy to get her to come to London, to fly her over. And she is an absolute master of the biwa. And we spent a day together and a long time before that talking. And she really showed me around that instrument and explained a lot to me. And that's featured quite strongly, especially there's a track called Heart of the Jito, where you can hear the biwa. It's a very special sound, I think. And that the music in that track is based on an important bit of music that she plays, which is a famous story called the Haike in Japan. People learn it in school. So I really wanted all the music to have this foundation in authentic Japanese music. And then even the orchestra, I applied the same rules. It was all Japanese pentatonic scales. And then there isn't much of a tradition of harmony in Japan, in the sort of vertical chordal sense. And so I created my own set of chords based on the pentatonic scales that I used throughout the score. And then once in a while, having made all these rules, you break the rules completely. And that has a certain amount of power. But that's how I created the score. It is really fundamentally rooted in every sense in Japanese musical culture.
And the idea of learning from the players seems to me to be where perhaps your penchant for research and your passion for collaboration meet. You know, the idea of if it's an instrument you've not written for before, you don't want to necessarily just write a melody you have in your head and have someone execute it, even if it's not what the instrument's for. You might in some circumstances, but just as often you want to know what the stylistic advantages or the formal limitations or the traditional uses of an instrument are, and make the score reflect that. And maybe even, I think you've said it's important to you for the player to leave a stamp on the piece.
Yeah, I mean, especially in this instance, I was looking for the input, for the traditional input, the stylistic, you know, I would say to the players, what kind of embellishment would you put in this if you were playing this in a traditional setting? And of course, the players will say, oh, we could play anything, we could do whatever you want. But I was really focused on, no, let's make this as traditional as possible. And I, of course, I've worked in other ways before where I've broken all the rules and used the instruments in other ways. But in this instance, it seemed important to do that. And also, the other thing is that it's quite inspiring to work in this way, because I can't remember who said this, but someone much smarter than me said, there is no art without resistance from the medium. And what that means to me is that, for example, if all you can afford to buy is small canvases and you're a painter, then you'll make small paintings and that'll become your thing. And maybe you'll become famous for that thing, right? And so when I have a small budget, for example, I see that as a challenge, as a good limitation, because when you could do anything at all that you want, sometimes it's hard to start. And so working with just a 5-note scale without being able to change key, without being able to be chromatic in the way that you would be in Western music, that was very limiting and meant that I really had to focus on melody and learning how the instruments worked and what they were capable of doing. Like, you know, the shakuhachi, yeah, it's got 5 notes, but you could play a note below and a note above each note. Mm. But on the koto, you can't play a note below because of the way the strings are. You can only play a note above what each note is. So they all have these particular limitations. And when you start to learn about that, then you learn how to write naturally for it, but also your creative process is informed by this, and it's good. It's good to be. I mean, we're always limited in art by whatever it is, by you know, the technology, by the instrument, by the ability of the player, by, you know, whatever it is.
one of the inherent limitations, but also opportunities of games in particular, is what I think you've called vertical narrative in other interviews, the idea that you don't have complete control over matching the sound to a sequence of images that are going to play out the same way every time, the same way you would in a film or on television. You've got to account for lack of a better term, player agency, right? But also perhaps a bit of randomness. I noticed while playing that the music, the fight music changes depending upon how many people you're having to fight at once. And there's a degree of you choosing your encounters and that being a reflection of the tactics you're using, but there's also just an element of chance where someone might happen by and join the fray. Was that an interesting limitation? Was it frustrating initially? The game takes incredible advantage of it, but you've done relatively few games. It's really been this and The Sims 4, as far as I'm aware of, which is quite a different soundtrack.
Yeah, well, but Sims it works in exactly the same way. You have this layered approach where depending what's happening on the screen, you can have more intensity or less intensity, and that is achieved by different layers, if you like, joining in or coming out. You know, I kind of think of it as a Big Mac, if you'll pardon the analogy, but you know, you have all these different layers and they could be quite interesting and tasty on their own, but they work really well all together, you know. But the challenge of it is that none of those layers, you know, like maybe in a Big Mac, that bit in the middle, the little bit of bread in the middle, that bit's not so interesting on its own. And it's like that in a lot of music, you know, whether it's pop or classical, the middle bit is there as filler. It's not necessarily interesting. It just thickens things up. But in game writing, that bit might be on its own. So what it means is that you have to write with incredible care and detail every single line of the music. And that is both a technical challenge and an artistic challenge.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I mean, in a lot of Western music, for example, like the alto part in a choral piece may sound like nonsense if you hear it on its own, but, you know, it thickens the broth, so to speak. It makes the chord richer. When you somewhat procedurally might hear any one of those parts either on its own or in different combinations, yeah, that's just an extremely different way of thinking about things.
Yeah.
Were there places other than the fights where that was something you had to keep in mind?
Yeah, you in every single bit that you write.
Sure.
Absolutely, because that's, you know, that's part of the production at PlayStation. They like to pull it apart and use it in different ways.
Yeah.
And it's necessary that, because that keeps the game fresh and interesting the whole way through, I think. You know, if you're like me and played, you know, video games in the 80s, then you would know how irritating hearing the same music over and over and over and over again could be.
Yeah, no, that's very true. That's very true. It's especially important, I think, what you're describing is especially important for an open world game, where you're going to have a bunch of adventures that are different, but follow theme and variation. I mean, like, mechanically, yeah. Right? You're going to have various showdowns, and you're gonna liberate various forts and farmsteads and things like that. Things are going to repeat, but not quite be the same way twice, and that is, in fact, the whole point, right? You're getting good at the skills and you're getting more efficient and perhaps more powerful and all of that, but you're having similar experiences but never the same experience. So that is, I think, reflected in the structure of the music in a very smart way. It keeps things feeling fresh. There's a lot of game in this game, so that's extremely important to not just have, as you say, like an 80s style looping melody in whatever situation you happen to be in.
Right.
I think you said somewhere that Sony sent you over a bunch of games. I know you don't play too many games nowadays, but both out of busyness and because your heart may belong to the Commodore in some sense. Fair enough. But I think you said Sony sent you over a bunch of games and or soundtracks and in particular, God of War caught your eye, caught your ear.
Yeah, I played God of War and Spider-Man. I was really blown away by the way Spider-Man moves and just the adventure and story of God of War was just beautiful. But the scores in both of those were just epic and amazing and technically incredible. And so it really gave me a sense of how high the bar was. And it just made me excited about what it was I'd be able to achieve.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Also gave me a little bit of anxiety, to be honest.
I was going to say, yeah, that might be a bit daunting because you're an extremely accomplished composer, but you've not worked in this specific setting quite
it's
as much.
It's not that. I mean, to be honest, you know, it's very kind of you to describe me that way, but of course, you know, it doesn't feel that way. It just, you know, I feel, you know, I go and I sit down and, you know, in front of the keyboard and it feels exactly the same as it did 10 years ago. And it feels the same as it did 20 years ago. I just have no idea what I'm doing. I'm like, you know, you sit down in front of those 88 black and white piano notes and it's the same 88 black and white piano notes that Wagner sat in front of and that Tchaikovsky sat in front of. And you just think, all right, pick one, let's go. How do you even begin? It's terrifying.
Sure. I think all artists feel that. I think a blank canvas or a blank sheet of paper is equally scary for similar reasons. You know, I think that's a unifying experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think coders feel it too, to be honest. I think that, you know, like, it's interesting because you're more likely to be using chunks of other people's code, libraries, engines, those sorts of things. But even then, there's this sense of like, okay, now it's up to me to make things work. Yeah, it's
but you know, and you know what how I get over it these days, my way of doing it is that I think just write something, anything, and then you can improve it later. So because if you sit down and you try to say, all right, I'm going to write a work of genius by, you know, can I sit down and write a work of genius by 6 o'clock and make it in time to go and meet my friend for a drink in the pub? And the answer is no, I don't think that's really, that sounds way too daunting. But could I write something really average by 6 o'clock and meet my friend for a pint in the pub? That is definitely an achievable goal, right? Sure, so that's what I do. I spend my life just sort of aiming low and just trying to get something done. And then I listen to it the next day and it's one of three things. It's either terrible, start again. Okay, but if I improve this and this, it's going to be great. Or there is the rare occasion where you go, wow, that one was pretty damn good. I got lucky there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people, there are people who could be Beethoven who are mad at themselves for not being Mozart, if that makes sense. They hear it a certain way in their head, and then when it doesn't immediately come out that way, they get frustrated and they don't want to scratch things out because they've already failed. And I think it's a very difficult thing to get past, I think, but it's a vital thing to get past.
No, you've got to keep working on it and improving it. And, you know, and to that end, I must have written twice as many melodies for Ghost as there are in it, which is a very usual process for me. I write things over and over and over again, and often the things I write at the start don't stay in, because, you know, you're getting to know the game, you're getting to know the characters, and I don't know, everyone's like that. So you think that, like, musicians just sit down and say, hey, you know, pop stars just write a 12 song album and they just wrote 12 songs. They didn't, they wrote 30 songs and then they whittled it down to the ones that were really good, you know?
No, exactly. Okay, I believe you said, though, that one of the first melodies you wrote was sort of Jin's main theme, which I believe is called The Way
Actually,
of the Ghost.
It wasn't, it was The Way of the Ghost. It's the main theme. And that was one of the first things I wrote. And then it was set to one side. And I wrote plenty of other stuff. And then eventually we came back to it. All together, PlayStation and me and Sucker Punch. And it came back. But it was, at the beginning, it was set to one side.
Interesting. And was it just that you tried a bunch of other things for that function or that sort of slot or that cue and none of them worked quite as well, so you eventually went back? Or was it just that
I was just writing ideas. It was just in the first, you know, bunch of, you know, 8 or 9 ideas that I delivered.
Yeah.
And most of those ideas didn't go anywhere. But that one, you know, that one was set aside, and then I did another whole set of ideas, and then we came back to that one. And I, you know, I really like that one because it is, there's something very pure about it. The entire thing is only made out of five notes. It's just very pure. It's made from the in scale in Japanese music, and it's a very pure idea. You know, it's very authentic, and it could be played by any Japanese instrument.
Yeah, you've mentioned, we've talked a bit about the biwa, which I think is an incredible layer to this that I think you're right that even if it's ever so slightly anachronistic, it's such an incredible thing because it doesn't necessarily, it's not the first sound I would think of when I think of warlike instruments. But of course, in this cultural context, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. I think most Western audiences, at least ones that consume Japanese media in a nerdy way, are somewhat familiar with the shakuhachi. Would flute be the right word? It's a wind instrument that as you said, has
like
that.
Flute. You play it vertically like a clarinet, but it's a kind of a flute.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the koto. Were there other instruments that were?
Oh yeah, there's the shinobue, which is more like a flute or a piccolo, which is a beautiful sounding instrument. We use that a lot. And shamisen, which we used some places. And then there's, of course, the Mongol instruments, the horsehead fiddle, which is just a remarkable instrument, and Mongolian throat singing. Shomyo, Junko Ueda sang for me, and her vocals are, I think, very important in this. Mm-hmm. Taiko drums, of course. Again, anachronistic. They weren't invented for quite a while later. But how could you not use them? And also, there's a series of chants that go with the taiko drums that I found whilst I was researching. And so I wrote that out for, it's in the piece, The Way of the Samurai. But it's funny, we went to Tokyo to record this incredible taiko ensemble. And when we got them to say the words, halfway through, they all fell on the floor laughing. Just, they couldn't stop laughing. I didn't understand why. And apparently, the way that I'd put two of these taiko sounds, they don't mean anything, they're just things that they say. Mm-hmm. The way I put two or three of these together, and the sort of rhythmic way that I put them together, made it sound like a really rude word in Japanese. And they all thought it was extremely funny, and we had to change it.
That's
the challenge of working in a culture and a language that you don't understand.
No, of course, you can stumble into that. Well, that's why it's so important to collaborate and to, you know, if you had taken the position of the arch august composer, the maestro, then you know, maybe folks wouldn't have felt comfortable telling you that. They would have just giggled under their breath and continued.
But also, you know, when you talk about the sort of maestro in that sense, and you know, I think people often think back to the classical, or a lot of the classical composers, but you got to remember that in the late Romantic period, there was a real nationalistic approach to music, and all the major composers like Sibelius, Dvorak, Tchaikovsky, they were taking folk tunes from their countries and embellishing them and turning them into these symphonic pieces of music. And then, of course, Dvorak did that with American music and slave music in the Ninth Symphony, you know, the slow movement. Ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum is a slave song. So this idea of adapting folk music is it's far from unique. It's, you know, it's something that the great composers have been doing for centuries.
Yeah. Well, as you allude to, it's sort of never quite apolitical. I mean, you mentioned Wagner as well, right? Wagner was trying to decide what Germanness was or define it, right? At a time when Germany was, you know, was just figuring out that it was Germany, right? Rather than being a bunch of, you know, scattered areas. How conscious were you of sort of that, of like the... the nationalist project? I mean, like, maybe the right way to ask this is to go back to the Mongolian music. You know, was your goal, again, just authenticity, to include some sounds and some ways of writing music that were authentic to that culture? Or how much were you conscious of the idea that when we see Mongolian characters in the story, we are sort of seeing them from a Japanese perspective, right? We're seeing them as the invaders. That's kind of a tough line to walk, I imagine.
Yeah, well, in the simplest sense, yeah, they're the bad guys, but in it, and the music needed to reflect that. So there's less, we did a lot of recording, folk tunes, different things, with an incredible player who in Britain who really knows this material. And but a lot of that didn't make the cut, unfortunately. And one of the key sounds that we used for the Mongolians was something that I played on, and I don't know what the instrument is, I call it, it's got like a snakeskin drum at the bottom and some strings. You sort of bow it like upright, like a cello. And it's made out of this sort of very sort of red mahogany-ish kind of wood. I bought it many years ago on some travels, I think maybe in Malaysia, but I can't quite remember. And I just bowed that on a very loose string because one of the pegs is broken. And it just made this sort of room kind of, I can't sing it, it's an unusual sound, but you might recognize it from the game. Mm-hmm. And so that plays the Mongolians, and it's nothing really to do with Mongol music. But then there's also throat singing and other elements, that frame drum and other things that are very traditional that I did use. So, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's not a history lesson. And so we do, right. We do take liberties, and we are just trying to create an atmosphere and transport people to a place. And so you do what you need to do to do that. And there was lots of things that I, you know, sounds that I created playing the violin and other things that I do sometimes in these kinds of scores that helped create that sound world. But I tried to root it in as much authenticity as possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I, if that sounded like an accusatory question, I absolutely didn't mean it as one. I just mean that it's a genuinely difficult thing, right? Because the narratives that you're basically the game is very consummate. And I get the sense that research was very important to everyone on the team. There is, of course, a certain sense that whenever you're retelling a war, whenever your hero is a cultural figure who was a feudal lord, and, you know, I mean, the samurai are invoked in, you know, by the right in Japan all the time now, you know, for complicated reasons, right? So the game is not about those things, but it is playing with fire, and I think it threads the needle pretty well. But it's an interesting thing that I imagine is in the back of your head at least sometimes when you're making a game about not just a clash, not just an internal clash, but an external clash, a clash of cultures, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't take it as a challenge or criticism. It's just that it is an interesting question, and it was difficult to work out what the sound world for the Mongols, for what that sound world would be. And, you know, and I think what's great is that Khan, the main, the leader of the Mongols, he's not just a two-dimensional cutout. He isn't just a bad guy. He's complex, and the way he talks about things, he's quite emotive, I think. And so the music needed to support all of that as well.
The argument in the game isn't so much about, you know, one traditional nation against another, but like the way that the war ties into Jin's internal conflict is it's more a question of a changing world versus a stable world, idealism versus pragmatism. Like I think the Khan is an interesting character along those lines.
Yeah, for sure.
I suppose just the other thing is it's probably quite a different project researching Mongolian sounds versus Japanese sounds, right? Just like the cultural visibility within the modern day countries of those things, it seems to me, are a bit different. Is that fair to say? Like there's a different process of research or a different set of resources involved, or is it more similar than I'm thinking?
No, well, I mean, look, research is research.
Sure.
You know, I had to find the right player, And he, you know, there was much less of that kind of music, so it was less intense. Mm-hmm. But he was incredibly, I looked online and I read about it, but the player was, he was a very knowledgeable person. And so he was able to help me understand what I needed to understand and to bring a lot to the table. And we recorded plenty of work with him, but in the end we only used a small amount of it, but we used what we needed.
No, and it's really effective. I mean, you instantly feel like you're in a different, you know, a different space, you know, in it, yeah. Literally, figuratively, cognitively, et cetera. I think it's quite effective. You talked about your playing a bit. I know that you end up demoing a lot of stuff. I know that your playing ends up in your scores sometimes. I mean, you sang in Shaun the Sheep, so that's of course the crowning achievement it was called the Baba Shop Quartet.
How do you even know that? Not many people know that.
I mean, it's deep in your YouTube page, but it's on your YouTube page. I mean, that's, you know, I can't take too much credit for research there. But I mean, you've talked a bit about how you scratch out violin melodies. I think you, is it you playing the Stroh violin in the Black Sea score, or is that?
Stroh viol. Yeah. That's a pretty rare instrument. I have one of those. It doesn't exist anymore, but there was an incredible music shop of all kinds of ancient instruments just down the street from my grandmother's apartment in Paris. And my mother's French, my grandmother lived in Paris. And I would always find amazing things in that shop. And yeah, I feel a great loss that shop is gone as the neighborhood has improved and gentrified. It's not, that place has disappeared because it was a treasure trove of instruments. Anyway, that's a great sounding instrument.
Could you describe it just for people who don't? I mean, they can Google it, obviously,
It's got a wooden neck with a black fingerboard like a violin. You play it upright like a cello. It's like a steampunk instrument, you know. And then it's got like a metal gramophone, old record player, gramophone record player, a thing that comes out the side of it. And it has one string and a metal bridge. And I guess it's got a membrane inside. I've never taken it apart to look. And the sound comes out of the horn, like an old gramophone record horn. And so it's like this wooden and metal thing. That's why I describe it as steampunk. And it's got one string. There are also violins and cellos. There are all sorts of instruments that are quite rare that have been made in that way. But you know what always makes me laugh is on the side of the instrument, it says Stroh viol, and then it says concert model, you know. I always think, wow, did you make a rehearsal model as well, like for like bedroom practice,
like a tiny little horn? Yeah. I mean, these were basically early experiments with amplification, right? They were, you know, if you have
I suppose so. They're from the late 1800s.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, as there are new instruments, the idea of controlling how loud something is, you know. That's absolutely fascinating. So is there how much of you is there in terms of playing on the Ghost of Tsushima soundtrack? And would it be fair to say that it's more on the Mongolian side than on the Japanese side, or is it peppered throughout?
There's something of me in pretty much every single track. There's bits of violin, but not in the way. If you hear a sort of strange, thin-sounding string instrument, I have this technique of playing. It ends up sounding quite breathy and fluty. I play incredibly quietly, and I put quite a lot of rosin on the bow, so you get a lot of hiss from the bow traveling across the string, and quite a lot of vibration, because the rosin helps the bow stick to the string, right? And it makes it vibrate. Sure. So you get quite a lot of vibration with very little application of weight. And I'll play either right on the fingerboard or right on the bridge, depending what kind of sound I want to make. But it ends up being a bit sort of, you get more of the note than you would normally. and it's very quiet, so it's very amplified, and I'll play, you know, there's quite a lot of melodies that I play in that way, and then another little technique, sometimes various things or string crossing things. So there's a fair amount of me playing the violin, and then bits of percussion that I might have played, other like this redwood instrument, and you know, other bits and pieces that are in the score. It's just part of this sort of made up sound world. You know, the instrument that plays a lot of melody is the cello, in a sort of swoopy style that is emblematic of Chinese music, which are very closely connected in some ways. You know, so we take liberties there, but the spirit of it is, I think, is intact.
It's what you were saying before, where you make yourself some rules and then you obey them until you can't. And then by the time right. It's time to break the rule, you've got a good reason for doing so.
Well, yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I was also going to say, you wouldn't want to hear me trying to actually play them in, because that's not a good sound. Not anymore anyway.
Fair enough. Well, one other thing I know you've said is that when you were a kid playing violin, film soundtracks seemed like cool classical music, and I suppose games are cool too, or have become the new cool thing. So thanks for making this cool thing, and thanks for talking to me about it.
Oh, thanks. I know we're running out of time, but for me, just to say that games are, it's just the next iteration of oldest human art form. You know, humans have always told stories, and the oldest version we have of that are cave paintings, right? And then cave paintings turned into people singing songs of their exploits, and that maybe turned into theater and opera, and that turned into novels, and that turned into, you know, there was ballet alongside that, and dance, and but all the time these were ways of people telling stories. And then we got cinema, and cinema's been around for time, 100 years, you know, that's a good run. But now I think we're in a golden age of video games, where the storytelling is just as powerful as anything that's come before it. And that really is what inspires my work. I just want to tell stories through the medium of music.
I can't think of a better place to end than that. So thank you tremendously for your time. I can't thank you enough. I will let folks know where they can check out both the soundtrack and the game itself. And now people know how to listen for you playing on it, which is kind of a good bonus. Well, thank you yet again. I know I'm saying thank you a lot, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. I hope this was as much fun for you as it was for me.
It was brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much. And just let me know when you're posting, and we'll do the, you know, the usual social media stuff.
Yeah, we'll do. And pleasure to meet you as well. And then have a good one.
Great. Thanks so much, Drew.
Yeah. So long.
Bye bye.
And that's the show. What happened to Alon's audio toward the end there? I don't know, and it was way too late into the proceedings to try and adjust it, so thanks for sticking with me. He was saying such good stuff. Anyway, I think we got through it together. Thanks for that. Ghost of Tsushima is available now on PlayStation 4, the soundtrack is available all over the internet music streamosphere, and you can hear more of Alon's work at ilanashkeri.com, that's ilanashkeri.com. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support bound by an honor-clad code from Francis Michelle Lopez and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from the Noun Project. You can find the show wherever podcasts are a thing, and if you like, you can support it at patreon.com/ETAO. Thanks tremendously to our current patrons, with a very special thanks to the mysterious Ian Kay, Lucas Cosin, and Carlos de los Santos. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and if you feel like it, check out the rest of what we do at etao.blog and at etaopod.com.